This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. What will climate change be like? Last week, it was hotter outside my studio in Western Canada than it was in Baghdad. Not far from us, the hottest temperature ever recorded in Canada, ever, was in the little town of Lytton, British Columbia. In the last week of June, they recorded over three consecutive days, culminating at 49.7 degrees C, over 120 degrees Fahrenheit. That doesn't happen in Canada. It has never happened in Canada, much less in June. A giant heat dome settled over western North America from California to Canada for over a week of brutal temperatures. The Canadian Government Weather Service said they had never seen a high-pressure blocking system like it. We are in an uncharted climate, a massive experiment with an atmosphere changed by human greenhouse gas emissions. We can see the heat haze as a cloudless sky draws the last moisture out of the soil and the last living plants. The fire danger is off the charts, beyond extreme danger. Sure enough, after 3 days of setting absolute Canadian heat records, the village of Lytton burned to the ground. Residents noticed smoke. They had only 15 minutes to drive out for their lives. Some did not make it. We don't know how many yet. The village was totally burned out at short notice. The next evening, as this massive weather system began to break down, 29,000 bolts of lightning, most of it dry lightning, without rain, hit the mountains. Fires multiplied all over. The highways on both sides of us have been closed by fires now and then over the last few days. We have our evacuation boxes and bags by the door. We have to be ready for our 15 minutes to get out. As luck would have it, just a few days previously, a bolt of lightning struck almost outside my studio. The telephone hybrid that connects me to our expert guests all over the world was destroyed by a surge over the phone line. Okay, time for some replays of interviews that predicted all this would happen. Then, the system drive on my relatively new computer died in the studio. The manufacturer, which sold me 2-day on-site tech support, has not shown up a week later, maybe today. I am recording this program on an ancient computer from my basement and uploading it from my phone. My guests have warned about extreme heat and storms for 16 years now on Radio EcoShock. This year I published a collection of those interviews with survival tips. The book Surviving the Age of Extreme Heat is available from the show website at ecoshock.org. So it is ironic that when the worst heat hits right here, computer breakdowns make it impossible to report on it. Here is what it is. The saddest Radio EcoShock interview ever was with Charlie Varon in Australia. Charles Varon is a scientist and I think the world's top expert on coral. He dove the Great Barrier Reef since he was young. It would not surprise me to find Charlie spent at least a year of his life underwater if you add it up. Charlie found and documented more types of coral than any other human being. He published a multi-volume encyclopedia of coral, which is still the standard. Coral comes in all kinds of colors and shapes and different little animals, and only an artist could dream of this stuff. But now Charlie is not adding new coral. He documents countless species and types which are disappearing as the oceans get too hot. Many parts of the Great Barrier Reef are dying in massive bleaching events. Coral serves as a nursery for almost one quarter of the fish in the sea. Later in this program, I will play my early feature where a scientist predicts most fish will be gone by the year 2048, and that's serious. So Charlie is seeing his life work, creatures in the undersea world, destroyed by climate change. It is so sad for him to have to tell us that. Other scientists have also become undertakers for, well, you know, frogs or bugs or whole forests that vanish forever. For my own part, in 2006, I began to broadcast the urgent need to take climate action, to change our lives deeply, to stop burning fossil fuels. We need to do that, I said, within 10 years. Otherwise, experts feared that by 2050, climate change would dominate and challenge our lives and make them hard. Well, they were wrong. In just 15 years, the extremes are here. Now, you may be thinking, well, that can't happen here. That's far away. It's not like that. Most people do think that way. Canadians never thought they would see temperatures like the Middle East, and certainly not in June. These weather extremes are popping up all over the world. I can't think of any safe place to recommend you go. So yes, this is about you. In 2007, the Arctic Sea melted away and scientists were stunned. This was an obvious and undeniable result of global warming. Since then, other mega signs are flashing red, including massive meltwaters coming off Greenland and mountain glaciers retreating all over the world. Let me add one more. I have several reports that always frozen snow on the high Rocky Mountains is now melting away. People are flying over. They see brown spots where there used to be snow always. You may recall a recent Radio EcoShock interview where one of the three sites chosen to study the record in permafrost caves was in the Rockies of British Columbia. They have been frozen for tens of thousands of years, and that permafrost is probably melting. It is too new for any study to catch up on it yet. What we do know is the snow reserve for water that feeds rivers over the western United States and Canada is melting under unprecedented extreme heat. As you know, reservoirs feeding agriculture for the continent and cities of the west are lower than anyone has ever seen. There were Great Lakes behind power dams that have now become low stream beds, and you can't get that hydropower. Unless we get unprecedented rain, rivers feeding the prairies are also going to reach astounding lows this summer. Now, we're talking about the grain and corn belt that feeds North America and much of the other parts of the world. In the West, fruit has burned on the trees, not in flames, but just crisped up and turned brown and died. Some trees are dying outright. In fact, whole landscapes are going dead and browned. Then, with any ignition source, they burn. In Lytton, British Columbia, they suspect a train ignited the tinder dry brush, and that burned down the town. We don't know yet, but it was not a forest fire, even though there were fires burning on either side of the town at that time. In these conditions, a discarded cigarette or a hot car muffler can set vast areas ablaze. Earth is becoming more flammable. West Coast cities have been seriously hit by this long-lasting heat wave. I lived in Vancouver, Canada, for 25 years. I began broadcasting there for a community-owned station, CFRO. We never lived in a home with air conditioning. I never met anyone there who had AC. Why would you need it? In that kind of climate, it's moderated by the ocean. Extreme heat never happens. Until it did. In the Vancouver area, there have been several hundred excess deaths during the heat wave. The coroner expects these are heat deaths. There will be hundreds more dead from California through Oregon and Washington State. Even before this heat wave, we already knew that heat kills more people in the Americas, in Europe, in Russia, and Australia than any other weather-related event, including hurricanes and floods. The heat in Portland, Oregon was beyond what anyone thought possible. Nothing is built for that. Many new apartments in these West Coast cities have windows that only open a few inches to prevent people falling out. They pump in fresh air from the roof, a place that is now too hot for any human to venture out. The problems go deeper. We learned from Radio EcoShock guest Matt Santamouris that humans can adapt to heat within certain limits, of course. So in Darwin, Australia, people can cope with heat over 100 degrees Fahrenheit or 35 C. But in London, England, when the temperature gets over 30 degrees Fahrenheit, just 32 C, the emergency rooms fill up with people suffering real heat symptoms. Likewise, millions of people on the west coast of North America were not adapted. They have never seen such heat. They never expected to. We don't know how many died yet. The experience was frightening, and it was dangerous for everybody. Outdoor life was canceled, unless you were standing chest deep in a lake, in a river or the sea. Naturally, air conditioning sales are through the roof. Companies cannot keep up with demand. You can't even get through on their phone lines. Even with current installations, the need for AC to survive has driven power consumption to absolute record highs this summer, right now. Once millions more people get air conditioning, new sources of power will be needed to handle the summer demand. Where will that energy come from? Will it be coal, gas, or oil? How about we bring back those super dangerous nuclear reactors and all the concrete you need to make them? Either way, this becomes a positive feedback loop where heat drives more energy use, which drives more greenhouse gas emissions, which brings more heat. This civilization is already entering the phase of climate change where we need mechanical help to survive. That was not the case in all human history. Now it is. There are all sorts of ramifications, including greater dependence on the grid and the centralized corporations and governments which try to guarantee that power. Heat changes the economy, it changes production, and even possibly your form of government. Eventually, it seems possible that all of those will break down as a rapid climate shift tears away parts of the system. Now our challenge is hard, but it is absolutely necessary. We need to slow down this greenhouse train. It is too late to stop climate change. That is already here. But we can save a planet worth living on for ourselves and for our descendants. We can and must prevent hell from arriving. I am recording this show with a little handheld microphone on an antique computer. My apologies that I cannot do more to cover the greatest heat events so far in North America. But there will be more, and they will be worse. My studio will be working soon. So what do I have for you? Information you need. Most of you have never heard these early Radio EcoShock productions, which were only broadcast in Vancouver, Canada. We have two interviews on the coming extreme heat and why it happens, both from 2006. We begin with the UK author and Guardian columnist George Monbiot. He spoke in a London bookstore after the launch of his book Heat in 2006.
Radio EcoShock.
One of the problems with climate change is that it stretches our imagination to breaking point. First, we have to accept that through our infinitesimal, minuscule actions, we are doing what all prior generations have dreamt of doing. In the past, people have danced for rain or prayed for the winter to end, but without much hope of success. And now we do it without even trying. And the idea that us, these tiny little specks on the scuzz on top of the planet, are able to exert an effect which sweeps across the entire atmosphere is almost incomprehensible. Then we have to accept that the actions which are causing this problem are actions which hitherto have been considered either entirely innocent or positively beneficial. Making a cup of tea for the next door neighbours, picking up your kids from school, flying to New York for your brother's wedding. Under the old pre-climate change moral code, all those were good things. Morally good things. Under the new moral code demanded by climate change, they're also bad ones. And we find that what climate change does is to present us with the spectacle of two valid moral codes in irreconcilable antagonism. When you look at that last example of flying over to your brother's wedding in New York, you see an instance of what could be the most intractable of all causes of climate change, the phenomenon I call love miles. Love miles are the distance between yourself and the people you love. To redeem those love miles, you must travel. And that traveling is the fastest growing cause of environmental destruction. We see in this phenomenon that the planet could be destroyed by love, not something we were forced to contemplate before. But perhaps most mind-blowing of all, hardest of all to grasp, the thing which challenges our imagination more than anything else, is the idea that we, these minuscule, puny, ridiculous bipeds, can actually turn this thing around and could start to change our behavior in such a way that we influence the pattern of the entire global atmosphere for the good rather than for ill. And this is such a hard thing to grasp that it strikes me that even within the environmental movement, few dare to believe it. What I've seen over the past year has been an extraordinary and rather frightening phenomenon that the great majority of people whom I've met and talked to about climate change about a year ago would say, well, yes, that does sound fairly serious, but is it really such a big deal? Do we really have to do anything about it? I mean, you know, it's one of these environmental problems which come up every so often, and surely it's not nearly as bad as people say it is. And that has switched almost imperceptibly and without any transitional phase at all to a position of equal moral abnegation, which is to say, it's too late, we can't do anything about it. Nowhere in between has anyone said, hey, this is a huge problem, it has to be stopped, and we're going to act to stop it. Well, a very few people have, but the majority of people who have taken an interest in it have gone from the sort of hopelessness of not acknowledging the seriousness of the situation to the hopelessness of acknowledging it to such an extent they believe they can't do anything about it. And what I set out to demonstrate in Heat and in this talk is that it is not too late, not yet, not quite, that there is still a chance of turning this around, that even with our puny human bipedal resources, we can change the climate for the better, and we can avert what could otherwise become the greatest catastrophe that humanity has ever seen. Now, that sounds like a wild statement, the greatest catastrophe that humanity has ever seen, and it's the sort of statement which the right-wing newspapers love to jump up and down all over. But the right-wing newspapers are run by people, well, in fact, all the newspapers are run by people who have no understanding of science whatsoever. I went to a meeting of some very senior journalists, 150 of them, some of the top journalists from all over Europe. And the guy who was running it, chairing it, John Snow, asked us to put up our hands if we had a science degree. And out of 150, three of us put our hands up. And that, to me, explained a great deal of what I've been reading recently and hearing recently and watching recently, that a lot of the people in the key decision-making positions simply don't understand what they're looking at. They do not understand the difference between peer-reviewed research published in a proper peer-reviewed academic journal, and figures made up on the back of an envelope by some bloke sponsored by Exxon. They do not understand the difference between a systematic review of the literature and cherry-picking, where you just go through finding the data which suits your case and ignore all the rest of it. And as a result, we see unconscionable volumes of nonsense published on an almost daily basis throughout the media. But what the science says is that climate change has the capacity, the potential, to make all previous crises look like sideshows at the circus of human suffering. Wars, acts of genocide, famines, plagues. We haven't seen anything yet by comparison to some of the possible predictions which have been made. In last month's edition of the Journal of Hydrometeorology, I'm sure you've already read it, there's a paper which shows that, well, for the first time, it manages to strike what seems to be a clear prediction of the level of wetting and drying across the global atmosphere over the next 100 years. It's been a controversial matter for some time because as the atmosphere heats, there's an increased rate of evaporation from the ground, which would be expected to dry the ground, but that increased rate of evaporation also means there's an increased rate of rainfall. And there's been a lot of dispute about what the balance is. Well, scientists at the Met Office, for the first time, have published a comprehensive model incorporating all the latest data, which suggests there's going to be a severe global drying by 2100. And what this suggests in particular is a drying of continental interiors, especially in sub-Saharan Africa and many parts of Asia, although that bit is not yet quite certain. That, if that is the case, combined with some of the other effects that we already know about, for instance, the inundation of coastal arable land by the sea, the salination of coastal aquifers, in other words, salt water as the sea level rises, creeping into your freshwater underground water supplies, and contaminating them and making them useless for growing plants or indeed for drinking water. When we see those in combination with several other effects, plus rising human population levels, we have a formula for a net food deficit at the global level. When you have a harvest which is in line with expectations under that model, there would not be enough food to go round. It's beyond my powers of description to try to explain what a world of 9 billion people in net food deficit would look like. But I'll leave it to your imagination. Now, that's not the only outcome which has been proposed. There was some correspondent of mine sent me an email which went as follows. Dear Mr. Monbiot, thank you for writing in The Guardian about climate change. It really is an extremely serious issue. If action isn't taken soon, the entire planet will turn into a desert. Well, I investigated this possibility and I regret to say that it's unfounded. The science does not support it, but the thought of baked Alaska and floating islands did come to mind. Barring that possibility, we clearly have a direct moral cause, a moral imperative to act on this. Perhaps a moral imperative greater than that we've ever faced before. If you're concerned about any development issue, whether it's hunger, whether it's access to fresh water, whether it's disease, you must also be concerned about climate change. We heard so much last year, and strangely almost nothing at all this year, about the Millennium Development Goals, which were going to make sure that no one went without education, no one went without fresh water, no one went without adequate nutrition, etc., etc. Those goals, which won't incidentally be met anyway because of a lack of funding by the G8 nations who made such great play of their generosity last year, those goals are not completely out of play if climate change is allowed to let rip. Now, the first thing I do in this book is to try to work out what level of cuts are necessary to prevent that catastrophe from taking place. What almost all climate scientists are now agreed on is that 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, and a global average warming of 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, is the point at which many of the worst impacts of climate change begin. One, the direct impacts, including the global drying, and we already knew before this latest paper that at about 2 degrees of warming, some 2 billion extra people are subjected to serious water stress. And major ecological impacts, for instance, it means the killing of every tropical coral reef on Earth, almost certainly the complete dieback of the Amazon, which is very close to what's called its critical resiliency threshold, in other words, very close to the point at which it just keels over because it becomes too hot, and the complete melting of the Arctic ice. Also, the possible triggering of the irreversible melting of the Greenland ice cap and the West Antarctic ice cap, both of which have the capacity to raise sea levels by anything up to 7 meters or so. But on top of all those direct effects, you have perhaps even more serious indirect effects. And this is the capacity of a temperature increase of that size to trigger off more climate change. In other words, to start what are known as positive feedback loops, climate change causing climate change. A classic example of this is the West Siberian peat bog. The West Siberian peat bog contains methane in very large quantities. Methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas, about 23 times as powerful as carbon dioxide. And it contains as much greenhouse gas as humanity emits. It contains 73 times as much greenhouse gas as all of humanity emits in 1 year. At the moment, that methane stays where it is. And it does so because it's locked up in permafrost. But of course, as the permafrost begins to melt, the methane's released. The more methane is released, the more permafrost melts, the more methane is released, and so it goes on. And there are many other examples of this so-called positive feedback. In other words, if we get to 2 degrees, 3 degrees becomes an inevitability. If we get to 3 degrees, 4 degrees becomes an inevitability. Beyond 2 degrees, in other words, it's out of our hands. There is nothing more that we can do. And at that point, we might as well give up, eat, drink, and be merry, because there's absolutely no point in trying to affect climate change when those positive feedbacks have begun. So we have to prevent them from beginning. And that means that we have to act now. But act to what degree? Well, when you look at the probabilities associated with certain volumes of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, you find that trying to hold temperatures down to 2 degrees or below corresponds roughly to a maximum, if you've got a high chance of preventing that from happening, you want a maximum stable concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere of about 400 parts per million. Now, we started in pre-industrial times with 280. We have now reached 380. We're almost all of the way there. But it doesn't mean that we have to prevent it from getting to 400. We can let it overshoot a bit, but then we have to bring it down to 400 in pretty sharp order. And we have to do so according to the probability analysis associated with volumes of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by 2030. Now, by 2030, at the same time as all this other stuff is going on, the ability of the biosphere, which is the totality of the world's ecosystems, to absorb carbon dioxide declines quite rapidly. At the moment, humans produce about 7 billion tons of carbon dioxide a year, and the biosphere absorbs 4 billion tons. By 2030, that declines to 2.7 billion. And that's for all sorts of reasons, including things like the dieback of tropical forests and the soil beginning to produce more carbon dioxide than it absorbs as the metabolic rate of the bacteria that the soil contains rises with temperature. And so what we see is that the ability of the world to absorb our pollution reduces just as the pollution is increasing as a result of the pollution. At the same time, as I've already mentioned, human population is going to keep rising, and UN estimates suggest by the middle of the century about 9 billion people. Put all this together, and you see that if you were to divide the amount of carbon we could sustainably produce in 2030 by the number of people expected to be on Earth in 2030, we find that our sustainable allocation is 0.33 tons of carbon. That means a 60% per capita cut worldwide between now and 2030. If that's to be allocated equally according to the principles of what's called contraction and convergence, that means in the rich nations, on average, a 90% cut in carbon emissions by 2030. That's what we need in order to prevent runaway climate change. Now, this sounds like a tall order. This sounds like a ridiculous proposal. But I think what I've demonstrated is that it is technologically and economically feasible. What I've done is to look step by step at all the major sectors of the economy, major in terms of their carbon emissions, to see how that 90% cut can be achieved without bringing industrial civilization tumbling down. Now, this isn't because I'm a particular fan of industrial civilization, but because it cannot work politically any other way. If I were to stand up here and advocate a return to agricultural society, for example, which I don't think I would do anyway, but if I were to do that, it would be pure self-indulgence, because I might find that I managed to persuade about 100 people in the United Kingdom that that was a good idea. If this is to carry political weight, if this is to work, I have to show that it's viable in terms which people are prepared to accept. In other words, that their basic comforts and basic prosperity will be retained, that they will be able to lead lives which continue to give them the sort of satisfaction which lives give them today. There will have to be some changes, but what I've tried to do throughout is to minimize the pain involved. Now, environmentalists quite often like pain, but pain doesn't work very well politically. So we've got to try to avoid it.
That was UK author and journalist George Monbiot launching his book, Heat, in London in 2006.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We hear way too much about how climate change will impact humans. What will happen to our cities near the rising seas? What about our food supply? But what about all the other gazillion species sharing space on this little planet? Hardly a word about them. That's why I was pleased to hear of new scientific research into the heat tolerance of wild animals. Can they handle a 2, 3, or even 5 degree rise in temperature? And for that matter, how do animals really cope with heat? Our guests are PhD candidate Jennifer Sunday and Dr. Nicholas K. Dulvey, Associate Biology Professor at Simon Fraser University in Canada, and he's co-chair of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. Along with Amanda E. Bates from Deakin University in Australia, they've just published a paper in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. And don't let this title scare you off, Global Analysis of Thermal Tolerance and Latitude in Ectotherms. It's about the heat tolerance of animals. I'm hoping to find out how a thick-coated bear survives if summer starts to reach tropical levels, or maybe a hairless ape dressed in blue jeans. You can see how this matters. We have Nick Dulvey and Jennifer Sunday with us on the phone. Let's start with you, Jennifer. What was the big question that drove this research?
Well, the big question we wanted to answer is how animals' physiology changes as you look around the globe. And we wanted to address some key assumptions that people are making in how animals are adapted to the environment in which they live. In our case, we started out very humbly. We just had a few marine organisms that actually Amanda was looking at, and she was looking at some patterns in how their heat and their cold tolerance changed based on where she had collected them and with latitude. And we wanted to see how that would compare to other animals around the world. And so we started to collect this data set, and as we did it, we realized the importance of trying to test these patterns and how heat tolerance changes with, for example, in our case, latitude, and sort of how animals' physiology interacts with where they're actually found.
So if you throw, Jennifer, a bunch of marine animals into one tank and the tank's a certain temperature, do they all end up being happy there?
That's a good question. No, I mean, it does depend on, to some extent, where they're found. And one of the findings of our study was that marine organisms, and so if you're picturing taking marine organisms from different latitudes, they're not going to do as well if you try to put them in the same environment. But what we found with terrestrial organisms is, at least if you're looking at heat tolerance, that they're going to be able to survive nearly the same short-term heat shock no matter where they were found in terms of latitudes and from the equator up to the poles.
Okay, well, let's go to Nick if we can.
Hi.
Hi, Nick. I see your interest in the conservation of nature, and there are many species expected to go extinct due to climate change. Do the results of this study have some bearing on that? Is there some way we can apply this?
Indeed. We heard a couple of years ago that, you know, somewhere around 20% of species are on land are likely to go extinct due to climate change within the next 80 or so years. That's a prediction. It's not an observation. And that prediction was based on how shifting envelopes of temperature as they move northwards are going to bring animals with them and in actual fact carry them beyond the limits of continental land masses and into the ocean. So basically butterflies disappearing into the ocean was the basis for that prediction. And the prediction's absolutely founded upon trying to understand the link between thermal physiology and geographic distribution. And while there are piecemeal studies of upper and lower limits to thermal tolerance in some species and in some locations, it's never been generally clear that there are some overall broad patterns. People have always questioned whether it's a feature of that particular group of frogs or that particular location. And you know, what Jennifer's done that's incredibly novel in this area of ecology is not just to look at one case study in one location, but to bring together everybody's case studies and analyze them with a common framework to really understand if there is a general pattern across all of these cold-blooded organisms across the world. And, you know, this search for patterns is called macroecology, and the implication is that when we see such a strong common pattern that there will be some underlying mechanism that we'll be able to further understand and You know, so this is really a fundamental piece of research that helps us understand the basis linking seasonal variation in temperature to animals' capacity to cope with temperature at different locations around the world. So ultimately, this will all underpin better predictions of how species will respond to climate change in the future.
And do I understand you correctly that this paper was based on cold-blooded species as opposed to bears or other things?
That's correct. To be honest, we're pretty humble marine ecologists ourselves, so being dragged kicking and screaming into the realms of lizards, frogs, and insects was a big leap already. But clearly, you know, this suggests that people studying the distribution and thermal physiology of warm-blooded organisms should get out and do a similar analysis for those species as well.
Jennifer, I'm told you didn't have to torture any animals under heat lamps to do this research. How did your team get the answers?
That's right. It turns out that people have been doing these studies throughout the century on their study organism or sort of a system that they're interested in. So all we did was collect all the data that we could find through the library and compile them and to sort of keep track of some of the important details of each study to make sure that we were accounting for different methodologies or things like that.
And this was about cold-blooded types of creatures. So did that include, for example, the insects?
Yeah, insects is a big part of the terrestrial part of our study, insects, frogs, and lizards.
And did you, in fact, find that there's a similar heat tolerance between those very different types of creatures?
We did. Our major question was how that heat tolerance changes with latitude. But as you suggest, when we put all of the heat tolerances of all of those animals on a plot, they're all relatively similar. But more importantly, the slope, so the decline with latitude, is the same in all of those animal groups, and it's not very much.
I don't think I really understood what you just said. So can you give me an example, perhaps?
So if you look at insects from Canada and the insects of, say, the same animal, same group down in Panama, we found that, and different species of related insects all the way through North America, we would find that the heat tolerance that they're able to, the high temperature that they're able to endure doesn't change with latitude. And then we would find the same pattern if we looked at frogs from high latitudes, mid-latitudes, and down towards the equator. And again, their heat tolerance was similar to the insect tolerance, but more importantly, we found that heat tolerance didn't decline with latitude.
Nick, I'm wondering, we've just talked about how similar types of animals have similar types of heat tolerance, perhaps, and we're talking about latitude. Did I read correctly in the literature that an animal that's in the north might experience the same type of heat for a few days that an animal down at the equator might experience for many days, and so that's why they have to have a similar heat tolerance mechanism?
Indeed. So we think there are two possible explanations for this, you know, this similar heat tolerance across latitude. And the first one is, as you describe, that animals, even at the highest latitudes, do get exposed to heat shocks, even if only for a handful of days each year. And basically, they need to retain, there's an adaptive value to retaining really high heat tolerance because, you know, you don't have to be cooked for very long to die, which is a permanent loss of fitness. So you need some buffer to cope with that really high levels of extreme heat that occasionally happen, even at the highest latitudes.
And I remember reading a study about how so many of the creatures, including the ones you studied, have a similar body form. I mean, there's a body, there's legs, there's eyes. And so I'm wondering whether this heat tolerance is something that could have developed many, many long ages ago, and then nature being very economical just keeps that mechanism going, whatever it makes.
Indeed, and that's the other hypothesis. You know, if you think that the average species has a lifespan in the fossil record of about 1 million years. You know, 1 million years is a long time. It's a lot of climate change. Glaciers have expanded and retreated multiple times during the last 1 million years. And clearly the link between the latitude or the number of degrees away from the equator and the temperature in degrees Celsius varies over evolutionary time. And of course, animals have tracked these isotherms up and down over the last tens and hundreds of thousands of years. So we think that this very high heat tolerance could also be an evolutionary legacy of glaciation cycles and so on. And if there's no real cost to retaining that high heat tolerance, then there's no reason to lose it. So at the moment, the challenge really is to try and understand to what degree, and it might vary between different groups, to what degree this high heat tolerance across latitudes is a result of an evolutionary legacy of multiple glaciations on land, or to what degree it's actually adaptive to help the species survive these very rare heat shocks that occur even at the highest latitudes.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith, and we're going to Jennifer Sunday. Your new study is about the heat tolerance of land species, but I've read that you've also done some research on another aspect of our carbon dumping, about how marine species adapt to ocean acidification. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I just presented at a conference a paper that's still under review, looking at how marine animals, coastal animals, are going to be able to potentially adapt evolutionarily to ocean acidification. So ocean acidification is sort of it's the elephant in the room for a lot of marine conservationists who are thinking about climate change because it's sort of the other CO2 problem. As the CO2 is released into the atmosphere, it's also being absorbed by the ocean, and it's a simple equilibrium, and the ocean is becoming more acidic through some changes in the carbon chemistry. We know that organisms are going to be affected. We can measure the effect in the laboratory, and we can say in about 100 years, this species is going to have a lower survival rate or a lower growth rate. But the outstanding question was if species are going to be able to adapt through evolution. So what we did was we tried to measure the genetic basis of the variation in how organisms react. So we looked at blue mussels and red urchins from our coast here in Western Canada. We measured the heritability of the traits that we were interested in, so how fast they can develop under a future acidified ocean. And then we did some simulations to see how quickly they'd be able to evolve.
Well, this is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking to two scientists, Jennifer Sunday and Nick Dovey from Simon Fraser University, who, along with Amanda Bates down at Deakin University in Australia, have released a new paper on heat tolerance. And I'll put a link in my blog where you can find out a bit more about this. And I really appreciate both of you talking with us today.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
These are voices from Radio EcoShock in 2006, warning the world of catastrophic climate change.
I wish I was a fisherman, tumbling on the seas, far away from dry land and its bitter memories.
The world is running out of seafood, and running out soon. Exactly 42 years from now, in the year 2048, there will be nothing left to fish in oceans. That's the precise and dire conclusion of a major new study released today by the journal Science. Fish in the sea. Can we undo the damage before they're all gone?
Clam bakes, crab cakes, and even fish sticks could one day be a thing of the past.
Oh my God! The fish are dying!
A new report says if current trends of overfishing and pollution continue, all seafood could be wiped out in 40 years, and not just ocean life. Ecologists are also worried about fish in lakes and rivers. Experts say it's not too late to turn things around. They're calling for new marine reserves, better management to prevent overfishing, and tighter controls on pollution.
That's what kills me about mass media news. Horrors never before known can be reported in those news voices, followed immediately by the trivial, as though the disappearance of fish in the sea is just another story. Personally, I thought this woman's reaction was a little more realistic.
Oh my God! I can't believe it! Ah! I had no idea!
A homophobic preacher admits hiring a gay prostitute? Now that is interesting. Everyone is clicking to find out more. The end of seafood? Not so much. These days, notice I did not say in these end times, environmental news requires a horror soundtrack with cues for when we should cry out or scream. I suppose that's part of the mission of Radio EcoShock.
As if predictions about the demise of the coral reef weren't bad enough, scientists also predict most of the world's fisheries are set to collapse in just over 40 years. A combination of overfishing and pollution are being blamed for the problem. Scientists from Canada's Dalhousie University led the international study, basing their findings on almost 8,000 species fished over the past 50 years.
Moan now.
Oh no.
This is Alex Smith, and we're taking a quick tour through the latest horror flick known as Reality. The essential facts are these. In the May 2003 issue of the journal Nature, two scientists from Canada's Maritime Provinces released their study, Rapid Worldwide Depletion of Predatory Fish Communities. Their research showed that 90% of all large fish, the upper-tier predators, were already gone, fish like tuna, marlin, swordfish, sharks, cod, and halibut. And they found it only takes 10 to 15 years for industrialized fishing to grind down any new stock to 10% of the original population. The few big fish that are left are noticeably smaller, one-fifth to one-half the size caught by a previous generation. The authors also called for a global effort to reduce the impacts of fishing, including fewer fishing boats, reduced bycatch, an end to government subsidies where they pay for all these boats, and for the most threatened species, cutting the catch in half. Little was done. Norman Meyer said, "We are in a massive denial and continue to bicker over the last shrinking numbers of survivors, employing satellites and sensors to catch the last few fish left. We have to understand how close to extinction some of these populations really are, and we must act now before they reach the point of no return. I want there to be hammerhead sharks and bluefin tuna around when my 5-year-old son grows up. If present fishing levels persist, these great fish will go the way of the dinosaurs." End quote. All right, in late October 2006, Dr. Worm was again the lead author in a major study by 14 scientists from Canada, the United Kingdom, the United States, Panama, and Australia. Institutions like Stanford University, the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, and Stockholm University were participating. It is titled Impact of Biodiversity Loss on Ocean Ecosystem Services and published in the journal Science for November 3rd. The team analyzed mountains of data about fish catches from around the world going back 50 years and even cross-checked against historical records up to 1,000 years old. Dr. Worm couldn't believe the computer analysis and so cross-checked the results by hand.
And I saw that the trend of collapse of seafood species projected into the future predicts that by the year 2050 there will be no more species left to fish. And I really recall the hair standing up in the back of my neck and a shiver down my spine as I watched over the students, and I thought, it's going to be in all of your lifetime and in my lifetime too. I'm going to be old, but still I will see this happen if nothing changes, if we don't change the way we're treating ocean ecosystems.
In a moment of disbelief, the figure showed that about 29% of the world's edible fish were already in a collapsed state by 2003. That's over 2,200 edible species no longer commercially viable. If humans continue to harvest ocean resources at the current rate while polluting the sea and the atmosphere, the graph of fish population drops to nothing around the year 2048. The report was cross-checked by an array of the world's top fisheries scientists, but it is common knowledge that we're fishing out the sea. Report after report has showed it. More and more areas are close to fishing, including the record-setting end of the great 500-year-long cod fishery off Canada's east coast. According to the study, species below 10% of their original size include many types of salmon, king crab, some scallops and oysters, tuna, trout, shrimp, sharks, and more. All of this comes as diet-challenged first-worlders are being advised to eat lots more fish to get those omega-3 fatty acids so important as brain food. The study also showed the importance of biodiversity. Ocean life is very interlinked, with special services rendered by both small and large organisms. When part of that natural mechanism is removed, the whole breaks down, and the speed of decline is increasing year by year.
That is true. We see that in the ocean, species are very strongly connected, probably more so than on land. For example, if you remove a large predator species like a shark or maybe codfish, you see a domino effect of cascading ecosystem effects down the food chain. This is something we not see as commonly on land. So we have to rethink for the ocean. We have to envision this as a house of cards where every element of this building is integral to the structure of the whole. What has accelerated is that it's many more people who depend on wild resources like fish and seafood, but also the industrial scale at which we're scooping up species from the ocean, the global scale at which we're operating now. There's no ocean region that is exempt from our impacts. Only 1% of the ocean or less is protected effectively from fishing.
Not all scientists agree with the paper's results, and some fishing nations have gone on the offensive against such dire conclusions. For one thing, even the authors admit they hope to stimulate public concern to head off the problem before seafood disappears forever. Worm and his team of scientists want fisheries to be managed for sustainable yields, with real control over sources of ocean pollution, better maintenance of habitat, and big ocean reserves. Like the recent Stern report on climate, these scientists say such moves are an investment in a livable future with real economic payoffs if we act, and greater, almost unimaginable, penalties if we go on with business as usual. More than 1 billion people depend on seafood as their main source of protein, not to speak of the ocean's great value in itself. After all these species have a right to exist without us coming around to collect them in nets or throwing them overboard as bycatch. Worm says, it's not too late. We can turn this around.
It's really important to notice that our analysis had a strong upside, and that is, wherever people have tried to reverse the loss of biodiversity through protective measures, they've usually been successful, and they've been successful within a relatively short time period, usually 3 to 5 to 10 years.
But less than 1% of the global ocean is effectively protected right now. He gives better management marks for stocks off the North Pacific, on Alaska, as an example of how fishing can be done sustainably. Sadly, though, most of the rest of the world is becoming depleted and fast.
For example, here in Atlantic Canada, fishing has been going on for 500 years or more, and groundfish stocks, after that long history, finally collapsed in the early 90s. There has been no directed fishery at these species so far, so this is 12 years, and there has been very little or no recovery over time. The problem there is that we really don't know how to fix it. We're not good at repairing something that doesn't recover on its own. We don't have a technological fix. We can't just replant things like we do on land. We don't know how to do that in the ocean. So we really rely heavily on the ability of the system to self-repair, to recover on its own. And what we show in this analysis is that that ability of the system to self-recover, self-repair, is tied very strongly into its biodiversity, the number of species in the system. I think we still take the recovery potential of the ocean for granted. We think if you collapse it, it's going to come back. That's what they thought in Newfoundland. That was what they thought over here. And that should be a strong warning to European countries that it actually can happen that it collapses beyond a point of return where it doesn't recover on itself. And as I said, we don't know how to engineer a solution in that case.
Neelesh Gundar, a spokesman for Greenpeace Australia, says ocean pirates are stealing up to $9 billion U.S. worth of fish a year from some of the world's poorest people. Greenpeace is calling for 40% of the oceans to become protected reserves to save the world's seafood.
Fish, you're
yes.
Describing.
It certainly is a war on fish, and what I'm saying is that we're winning it. We have won the war on fish.
And we're going to wipe them out, the very last one.
That is, it's crazy, but it is exactly what's happened. We have deployed industrial military technology against the fish, and we have obviously won. The biggest fish have brains the size of peas. And the way they defend themselves against their enemies, by hiding or swimming fast, etc., to us, they don't make much of a difference anymore. Before they did, if a fish could hide between rocks at 1,000-meter depth, then you couldn't catch it, you couldn't see it, obviously. It was too deep. And even if you could reach that deep with your net, you couldn't catch it because it was between rocks. But now we can see it because we have all the equipment to see it. So we see it ridiculously, like a soldier who has night goggle who can see somebody who doesn't, right? And so we win. We win the war against fish.
Professor Daniel Pauly is head of fisheries at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada.
Just recently, the United Nations is trying to implement a ban on one of the most destructive fishing practices, trawling of the deep seabed, often compared to clear-cutting on land. To its international shame, Canada is one of the few countries opposing the ban, even when Canadian scientists are warning of an end to global fisheries. The same kind of protect-the-jobs thinking by Canadian politicians led to the total collapse of one of the richest fisheries in the world, the East Coast cod. Even with new ocean protection measures, events on land are also damaging ocean life. Deforestation cuts into marine weather cycles as well. And of course, global warming impacts fish and all ocean life. Some marine testing stations in Canada have measured an increase of more than 4 degrees in the ocean temperature. And carbon dioxide from coal plants and vehicles is making the ocean more acidic, hampering the development of tiny sea creatures and coral that support ocean life. Doctors Worm and Myers have also written papers on managing fisheries during climate change. That's something you're going to hear more about as warmer waters power up the hurricanes and fresher waters dilute climate-regulating ocean mechanisms like the Gulf Stream. Extinctions of whole ocean ecosystems are possible if they cannot adapt to rapid temperature change.
We see the end of the line. We see where this trend, which is a very strong trend, is heading. If we go on like we did over the last 50 years, there will be no viable fisheries left within our lifetimes.
Even scientists have leaks to the media these days. An email to colleagues went to the Seattle Times by mistake. In it, Dr. Worm hoped that his projection of ocean death would serve as, quote, a news hook to get people's attention. One reason why nobody cares about marine biodiversity, he continued, is that there seems to be no clear end in sight. Well, it's time to wake up. If the current trend continues, we will see drastic consequences in our own lifetime, end quote. This report certainly got my attention, despite lame efforts to cover it by mass media news outlets. I hope it got yours, too. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, the net's only all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org. Voice clips are from the Today Show on BBC Four and from ABC National in Australia. We had music snippets opening with the Waterboys tune Fisherman's Blues, a snatch from Bob Holman's We Are the Dinosaur, and ending with the Marvelettes classic Too Many Fish in the Sea, a common expression until now. You have been listening to a younger Alex Smith with Radio EcoShock in its first year, 2006, as broadcast on CFRO Co-op Radio Vancouver. Now we're on 104 nonprofit stations in 4 countries and downloaded by people all over the world. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world. And caring about your world.